This is Audible.
Listening Library and Mainframe present Evershore by Brandon Sanderson and Jancy Patterson, narrated by Susie Jackson. For Darcy Cole, who let me borrow her faith for a while. JP. Prologue.
Jorgen, are you ready?
My father asked, standing in the doorway to the parlor. He looked over my graduation uniform, admiring it, I thought, but also searching for anything out of place.
Yes, I said.
I stood in front of the glass case filled with my mother's medals. She was one of the most decorated pilots the Defiant Defense Force had ever seen. At the center of the case was a pewter figure of a Saigo-class fighter, the ship my mother used to fly. As a kid, I used to stand here and stare at that ship for hours, imagining what it would be like to be a pilot someday, fighting the Krell, all thrill and heroics and glory. I never took the figure out of the case. My mother would have killed me. But in my mind, I flew in that ship to the stars and back. I could see my reflection in the glass, my dress uniform crisp and fitted. After today, I'd be a full pilot.
I hope you know how proud we are of you, my father said. So many cadets begin flight school, but graduating is a real accomplishment.
My father was right. I'd started with what had to have been, in my estimation, the finest flight of pilots the DDF had ever seen. They were incredible people, every one of them. I couldn't have asked for a better team. And of all of us, only two remained. We'd lost some amazing people in the months of cadet training. Rig, Bim, Morningtide, Netter, Amphi, Quirk, Hurl, Spin. We needed them, but none of them were graduating today, and the DDF was poorer for it. That didn't feel like an accomplishment. It felt like a tragedy, one that was mostly on me. What worth was I? A leader who couldn't bring his team with him? My mother came down the stairs in her own dress uniform. She wasn't officiating, but she'd still be there in all her regalia. She crossed the room to the case and opened it, pulling down her medals and pinning them on. She looked up at me, taking in my uniform, though it didn't feel like she was looking for imperfections the way it had with my father. I felt like she was seeing herself.
This is an important day, she said. You've done every bit as well as we hoped you would.
Thank you, I said, because it was the right answer, not because I felt it. I'd earned the pilot's pin more than I had the cadet's one. That had been automatic because of my mother's accomplishments. Still, I couldn't help wondering, did I deserve to be here? Would Ironsides ever have kicked me out of cadet training, the son of Algernon and Jeshua Waite? I'd tried my best, done everything I knew how to do. But if I hadn't, I would probably still be standing here, my whole life laid out before me, predetermined just like my uniform.
How does it feel to finally make full pilot? My father asked.
This, too, had a right answer.
It feels great, I said.
I glanced back at the now empty medal stands and allowed myself this one admission. Not that I'll be flying for long. My mother's lips set into a line.
Thank the stars, you won't have to.
I'd been told before I started flight school that I'd only fly active duty for 6 months. I should be grateful for that, but I wasn't. I wondered if FM would get to keep flying, or if our whole flight had been trained, using DDF resources, all the focus we'd put into it, the lives of my friends, for nothing. I knew better than to say that aloud. I didn't need the lecture about how every sacrifice was part of a greater goal. I knew it by heart. I'd occasionally given it myself. I could never say my mother didn't understand. She understood better than anyone. She was a decorated pilot.
She'd lost friends, flight leaders, wingmates. I could see the heaviness in her eyes, the burden she carried. She pushed on, doing everything she could for our people, because she believed in the cause, because we had to survive. I was afraid I would never have the stomach for it, that I was soft and weak, and would never be able to harden myself to do what needed to be done. But if I was being honest with myself, I was equally afraid that I would.
Chapter 1. 7 months later. Enough. I stood in the landing bay on Wandering Leaf, staring through the windows at the exploding superiority ship as the wreckage spiraled out into the blackness of space. The eerie blue shield of detritus loomed in the distance. My flight stood around me, all watching the remains of the explosion, the tomb that had claimed my parents and half of our National Assembly. We were supposed to have saved them. We were supposed to have won. Instead, we'd barely gotten ourselves out alive. I could have died in there. I almost did. I should thank Alanik for pulling me out, but I felt frozen, like something inside of me had died after all.
Did Gran-Gran? Rig asked.
She escaped, Alanik said. So did Cobb. I saw them.
I could feel her reaching out through the nowhere, searching for them.
But I don't know where they are.
At least they weren't here, FM said. She put a hand on my shoulder, but I shook her off.
Boom,
Boomslug said mournfully, looking at the wreckage. I didn't know what to do with his sympathy, let alone everyone else's. They were all staring at me, waiting to see what I was going to do. This was the moment a good commander should give an inspiring speech, maintain morale, treat this as a setback. It wasn't a setback. It was a scudding disaster. I didn't have anything inspiring to say. I wasn't even sure how I was staying on my feet. I had to, though. They were all looking to me, or at me. I couldn't really tell. I wasn't going to fall apart. Not here. Not where my entire flight could see. Fragments of the ship spun out into space, while others careened toward the planet. One hit the shield around detritus and bounced off. In my mind, my mother looked directly at me.
Do better than we did, she said.
Enough. In the distance, the superiority station that monitored detritus blinked out of existence, hyperjumping away. They wouldn't even give us the dignity of revenge. They'd run like cowards. There was no one left for us to attack, just the terrible wreckage floating ever outward, a monument to our diplomatic failures. We're going down to Platform Prime, I said. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see the others looking at each other, not sure what to make of that.
Okay, FM said. But I think you need to stop for a minute.
No. I couldn't stop. This wasn't about me. It wasn't even about my parents. It was about what we were going to do for detritus.
Now, I said.
The Erdale were expecting us back to finalize our alliance. That was more important now than ever. The war went on, and we were losing badly. We had to get back on track, and the only way to do that was to find Admiral Cobb and return power to the DDF. The Assembly had had their chance. We were looking at the remains of it.
I'm sorry, Alanik, I said.
We'll be a little late returning to Redon. There are some things we need to take care of first.
Jorgen, FM said, I think you should sit down for a minute.
I couldn't. Put Gil in the hyperdrive, I said to FM, mostly so she'd have to stop talking. I'll give him instructions to take us into the airspace beneath Platform Prime. FM hesitated long enough that I looked back at her. It was a mistake. She was watching me with so much concern that I wanted to shout at her, scream at the sky, break things. But I was the flight leader. It was my job to stay in control, at least until Cobb was back. He'd probably try to send me on leave then. I'd tell him I didn't want to go,
We needed every person to face what was coming. Maybe Cobb would see that. Maybe he'd let me stay.
Do it, FM, Arturo said.
Yeah, okay, she said. She headed to the control room, and Rig went with her. I turned to Alanique. I need to know where Cobb is, I said. Where did Gran Gran take them?
I don't know, Alanique said. I'm looking for them, but I can't find them.
I closed my eyes, reaching out toward the planet. It would make sense for Gran Gran to take them somewhere beneath the surface, to her home, maybe, but I couldn't sense her mind. Not on Platform Prime, not on the surface, not in the caverns below. Keep trying, I said. Once you find Gran Gran, we can go pick them up. I strode toward my ship, turning my back on the glowing wreckage. I didn't need to see it again. The spiraling shape was already fixed in my mind, expanding outward forever.
Boom, Boomslug said.
Boom, I agreed with him.
Jorgen, FM called. We're ready.
I reached out to Gil, giving him a clear impression of the airspace below Platform Prime. Wandering Leaf was an abandoned battle platform with hyperdrive technology, and its autofire could tear other platforms to pieces, so we'd need to park it far enough down in the upper atmosphere that the other platforms would be out of range.
Go,
I told him. And then I floated beneath the vast starscape of white eyes. They didn't focus on me. We were invisible to them as long as we used the slugs to hyperjump. But I didn't like the eyes any better when they couldn't see me. I always felt as if they could see through me, like I was made of something flimsy and superficial, with nothing substantial underneath. This time, though, I felt something different, something new. I hated them. It was irrational. They weren't the ones who'd spent the last 80 years raining down death on my people. They hadn't trapped my parents in a ship and blown the thing to pieces. I didn't know if they were responsible for these strange powers I had neither asked for nor wanted. As far as I knew, they weren't even responsible for taking Spensa away. She'd done that herself. But I still couldn't smother the sudden, startling feeling that at its core, everything bad that had happened to us was all their fault. Wandering Leaf emerged far below the vast metal underside of Platform Prime, the current DDF headquarters. Flight, I said. Take your ships up to the landing bay.
What are you going to do? Ned asked.
The raw hatred I'd felt for the eyes was still hot in my veins. It felt good, better than the icy chill of shock or the raging terror of grief. I'm going to make sure no one else does anything stupid until Cobb gets back, I said. I climbed into my ship. I'd already given my orders to the flight, so I left my radio off.
Cobb gets back, Snuggles said,
settling on the floor of the cockpit by the side of my seat.
Let's hope it happens soon, I said.
And then I directed Snuggles to hyperjump my ship out of Wandering Leaf and up to the landing bay of Platform Prime. The ground crew looked shocked when we appeared. They wouldn't have been able to see the explosion from here, not with the platforms forming the shield above them. But word spread fast when half your government was annihilated. I left the slugs in my ship as I disembarked.
We're under orders to arrest you for desertion,
Dobbsy, one of the ground crew members, said. She looked at me uncertainly, like she didn't want to be the one to carry out that particular arrest. A good call on her part. Admiral Cobb gave us orders to leave, I said. He'll clear everything up when he returns. Dobbsy hesitated.
Where did he go?
It's classified, I said. It wasn't a great answer, but it was the only one I had. My flight hyperjumped into the hangar, their ships all connected by light lances. FM and Alanique jumped out first, and the ground crew looked suspiciously at Alanique, like she might be the cause of all the trouble. Alanique stared them down, but she did move quickly over to me. FM looked at me with that terrible sympathy in her eyes again. Before she could open her mouth, I turned on my heels and headed toward the command center. There wasn't time to stop, not now. I had to make sure that my flight wasn't going to be scudding arrested. The assembly's plan had blown up in all of our faces, literally. We were going to do this Cobb's way now, whether they liked it or not. I walked in, Alanique and FM on my heels and the rest of the flight trailing behind, to find the command center in shambles. Cobb's aides were all staring at monitors and talking over the radio to various DDF departments on the platform and on the ground. Commander Ulan and Zyming from engineering were having an argument near the hypercom, while Rakolfer from the admiral's staff kept trying to page Cobb, but to no avail. They couldn't find him either. Without him, the explosion of the superiority ship had sent the staff into disarray. Enough. Admiral Cobb is alive, I said loudly. Most of the room turned to look at me. The person who's been giving you orders since last night was a superiority plant using a holographic disguise.
Not how I would have started, Alanique said in my mind. You don't have proof of that, do you?
Anyone who doesn't believe me, I said, is invited to find Cobb so he can confirm. He was kidnapped and taken to the superiority ship. The one that blew up, Commander Ulan said. That's the one, I said. He and Mrs. Becca Nightshade escaped together. They'll be making their way here soon, and until they get here, no one else is going to do anything stupid. Do you think you can all handle that? You're back, a voice said from behind me, and I turned to see Vice Admiral Stoff striding toward me. He was one of three vice admirals who served under Cobb. My flightmates stepped aside to let him pass. Rig followed behind him. He hadn't had a ship, so he'd probably asked Drape to hyperjump him to the slug's home location in engineering. Flight leader, wait. You're under arrest for... Not this again. I wasn't going to sit in the brig and watch while more people I cared about got hurt. The charges were a sham, I said. Either they were issued by my mother, who didn't have the authority, or they were given by the false Admiral Cobb, who was actually an alien wearing a hologram. Vice Admiral Stoff blinked at me. This was definitely not the attitude I was supposed to take with my superior officer. On a normal day, I would have been horrified with myself. Today, I had met my capacity to experience horror. I wasn't looking forward to the moment it all caught up to me. An alien wearing a hologram, Stoff repeated. Yes, I said. You know, the hologram the superiority learned how to construct by disassembling the remains of Spence's starship, the one we handed to them. Stoff looked around the room, but no one spoke. How do we know that's true if Cobb's no longer here?
It's true, Alanique said.
Stoff sighed. We'll take you to the debriefing room, he allowed, like he was doing me a great service. We can make a determination about the court-martial proceedings after. No, I said. Stoff stared at me. What was that? No, I said. We have an alliance to formalize with the Urdale on Redon, and my flight and I are expected to be there. Stars. I didn't know how I was going to get through that kind of political meeting. I lacked diplomatic finesse at the best of times. Just look at how this was going. Flight leader, Stoff said, that alliance hasn't been authorized by the assembly. The assembly got blown to bits, I said. Do you have footage on the monitors? Should we replay it for you? I'm aware, Stoff said. But you don't have the authority to. Saints, if we were going to talk about authority, I could talk about authority. Section 1809 of the DDF Command Protocol says that the chain of command can be temporarily interrupted in the event that the commanding officers are unaware of intelligence that would change their orders beyond reasonable doubt if they were aware. In this case, Stoff said, there is no such intelligence. You have been taking orders from a superiority plant, I shouted at him. You couldn't tell the difference between Admiral Cobb and the alien who took his place. And he wasn't even all that good at pretending. Vice Admiral Stoff's mouth opened like he wanted to defend himself, but then he shut it again. Meanwhile, I said, my flight and I have been off on another planet, trying to secure an alliance so that all of you might live to see another day. Cobb ordered us to find allies, and we did. We have a military full of Erdale fighters ready to challenge the superiority with us. Meanwhile, you all were trying to bargain with them. How did that turn out? Stoff stared at me with his mouth hanging open. I was only a flight leader, but because of my parents, everyone in the DDF knew who I was. Despite the recent charges, I still had a reputation for being a rule follower. His outburst was the last thing he expected from me. You know what? I said before he could respond. Maybe we should call my mother and ask her. Stoff looked up at the ceiling. I waited for him to cuff me and take me to the brig, but instead he nodded. We need to have that debriefing. Stars, yes, we do, I said. But in the meantime, no one is doing anything until Admiral Cobb is back. Technically, sir, Rakulfer said, Vice Admiral Stoff is in charge in Cobb's absence. He would be in command if Cobb was indisposed, I said, but Cobb isn't indisposed. He will be back soon, and my flight and I are the last people to whom he gave orders and direction before he was kidnapped. I didn't technically know if that was true, but none of them could contradict me, given that they hadn't even realized Cobb had been replaced. If Cobb were here, he would agree with me, because you people are a mess without him. If you want proof, look at what happened to the delegation you sent. Fine, Stoff said. Until we can get all the information to the Assembly, no, I said. No more talking to the Assembly. Stoff stuttered at me.
You should point out that their peace deal turned out to be a sham, Alanique said in my head. They have no hope of securing an alliance with my people without you, and they desperately need one.
Good point, I said to her.
All hope of securing a treaty with the superiority is dead. Our only path forward is to ally ourselves with the other peoples the superiority is trying to oppress, and you're going to need cytonics for that, unless the Assembly has found a way to get themselves across the expanse of space without us.
We'll see what Admiral Cobb has to say when he returns, Stoff said, and then he spun and strode out of the room again, with the air of a man who had lost an argument but didn't want to admit it. I reminded myself to breathe. Stoff wasn't going to let me get away with this forever. He was giving me some leeway because I had information he didn't, and more because of what had happened to my parents. We need to find Cobb immediately, I said, mostly to myself.
Where is the Admiral now? Rakulfer asked.
I looked over to Alanique and she shook her head. I couldn't pull off telling this crowd it was classified. A lot of them had security clearance higher than mine. We don't know exactly where he went, but he'll be back soon. He'd better. There was only so long I'd be able to hold things together in his name before people started questioning why they should listen to me. I was questioning it already.
Sir?
Ashwin from the Communications Corps held a radio out to me.
National Assembly Leader Winter is on the radio. She wants to talk to you.
To me? I wondered if any of what I just said had been broadcast over the radio. There were several people who'd been in the middle of conversations when I'd walked in, and it wasn't a complicated procedure to switch from headset to ambient reception. I wondered if NAL Winter wanted to yell at me for what I'd said to Stoff, or give her condolences about my parents. Either way, I didn't want to hear it. And while I had some things to say about what I thought of the Assembly, none of them would be productive. Take a message, I said.
Sir? Ashwin said. Under the circumstances, take a message, I said, in detail.
And then tell her that according to Section 57 of the DDF communications policy, the DDF has 3 days to respond.
Ashwin blinked at me. 3 days, sir?
Yes, I said. This fiasco had been the Assembly's idea, all of it. It was their fault, and I wasn't going to listen to a word they had to say even 1 second before I had to.
And then make yourself a memo to remind us 2 days and 23 and a half hours from now that we need to draft a response. Or better yet, make a note to tell Cobb to do it, because he will be back by then. Is that clear?
Yes, sir, Ashwin said.
Good. I turned around and found FM watching me nervously. Are you going to tell me I should talk to the assembly? I asked.
No way, FM said. Not a chance. You're absolutely right. That disaster was their fault. Being made to wait is the least of what they deserve.
But Jorgen, you need to talk about what happened.
You want to talk about something? I said to FM. Let's talk about how we're going to find Cobb.
We both looked at Alanik, who held up her hands.
I'm trying, she said. It's a big universe, Jorgen, and I don't know where Gran-Gran tried to take them.
She'd never been off this planet, had she? FM asked. Where else would she go?
She was born on the Defiant, Rig said. She used to travel the stars as a little girl, but she said she didn't remember much about it. I can't imagine she'd try to take them anywhere else.
They aren't here, Alanik said. I'm sure of that.
FM looked to me for confirmation. I closed my eyes, reaching down beneath the surface of the planet again. There were more slugs down there. I could feel their vibrations. But no Cytonic people, and definitely no Gran-Gran. I think she's right, I said. But Spencer managed to contact me from the nowhere. If she could do that, we should be able to find Gran-Gran wherever she is, right?
I'll keep trying, Alanik said.
Arturo stood behind her in the doorway.
Come on, he said. I'll find you someplace quiet where you can concentrate.
Alanik nodded and turned to follow Arturo out. I was being too hard on her, probably. It wasn't her fault Cobb disappeared. I'd apologize after we found him.
Jorgen,
FM said. I knew what she was going to say. She'd said it several times. What I need, I said, is to find Cobb. Are any of the slugs familiar enough with the Admiral to hyperjump to him?
I don't know, FM said. We haven't tried to get them to recognize him, but some of them might.
She looked like she was going to go back to arguing that I should sit down and stop for a minute, but I didn't want to stop. I was outrunning the storm right now, and I was going to keep running as long as I could. Find out, I said. Get Rig on it, too. I turned and strode down the hall into Cobb's office, closing the door behind me. I didn't know what to say to any of them. Not about what happened. Not about what had to happen now. Cobb would know what to do with all of this. But he wasn't the one I missed most at the moment. In my mind, I watched the superiority ship explode over and over again. Some of that image must have leaked into the nowhere, because Snuggles and Boomslug appeared on my shoulders, and Boomslug slid down my arm into the crook of my elbow and softly trilled, "Boom." "Can you find Cobb?" I asked Snuggles. She responded by nuzzling my ear, but she didn't take us anywhere. I pressed my back against the door, closing my eyes. More than anything, I wished Spencer were here. Chapter 2. 2 days later, we still hadn't heard a word from Cobb. Alanik tried her best, but no matter where she looked, she couldn't find Gran-Gran. They'd simply disappeared, she said. At this point, I was the only Cytonic from Detritus who hadn't mysteriously disappeared. Spencer was stuck in the nowhere, but she'd at least managed to get in contact with me twice. It had been several days now, and I was anxious to hear from her again. But from Cobb and Gran-Gran, there was only silence. I sat at a conference table with Alanik, FM, and Minister Kuna, the dissenter superiority bureaucrat. Boomslug and Snuggles snuffled around under my chair like they expected someone to have spilled some caviar down there, though the floor was swept twice a day as per Mandate 27 of the facility's regulations. Alanik had just returned from Redon with half the flight,
I'd sent Arturo, Ned, and Kimmelin to finish solidifying the alliance.
Rinnakeen is prepared to send a flight of ships to Detritus as a symbolic gesture, Alanik said. And more, certainly, if there's a need for them here.
I struggled to focus on what she was saying. I'd barely been sleeping. Every time I closed my eyes, that ship exploded in the darkness. In my dreams, I watched my mother mouth those words at me through the glass. Do better than we did. The ship tore to pieces before my eyes, sometimes while I watched from the platform, sometimes with me still inside it, somehow conscious of everything as it shredded me. In the very worst nightmares, it was Spencer on the other side of the glass. Redawn is more vulnerable, I said. We have the planetary shield to protect us. We should be sending flights to defend you.
The Tanix will help with that, FM said.
We'd given Rinnakeen a single Tanix of each type, and we already had people from the ground crew scouring the caverns of Detritus for more. We'd lost many in the trap set by the Superiority, and we were going to need all the hyperdrives we could find in the coming days.
Do you think Stoff will let us take flights to Redawn if the Superiority attacks again?
FM asked. Maybe, I said. I'd stayed behind while the others went to Redawn, because I'd wanted to be here to keep an eye on things until we found Cobb. He's been weirdly receptive to my suggestions.
Do you think it's because he agrees with you? FM asked. Or because he sees an opportunity to escape blame if all this goes wrong?
It's the second, I said. Once Stoff got over the idea of me challenging him, he'd become almost too accommodating. If things went well, I fully expected him to take credit for all of it. If we crashed and burned, he was going to pin it all on me. But I don't think Cobb is going to reprimand me for trying to protect our people in his absence. FM looked concerned. She was still doing that a lot in my direction. She'd mostly stopped trying to corner me to get me to talk, which was good. I didn't need to talk. I needed to stay focused, move forward. My refusal to let her talk to me also meant we still hadn't addressed the fight we'd had on Redawn. Her words still rang in my mind. You're not my flight leader. I understood why she'd said that. She'd been rightly worried about the Tanix being turned over to the Superiority, but it still stung. We were all trained to follow orders, to do as we were told. How bad must I be at this if a member of my own team, and a friend, I'd thought, could disavow me so easily.
Winzik will not take the defeat on Redawn well, Kuna said. Detritus might be the more difficult target, but he will only see that as a challenge to his authority. He is probably mobilizing more ships even now. He will gather enough force to break through Detritus's shield eventually, even with the cytonic inhibitor in place.
That was true, but I didn't know what to do about it. I didn't think Stoff did either. We need to find Cobb, I said. He'll know what to do. FM looked doubtful about that, but she didn't voice it.
About Cobb and Mrs. Nightshade, Kuna said.
A pin on their collar translated their words, which were spoken in an alien language.
If Mrs. Nightshade merely took them to another room on the Superiority ship, they might still have been caught in the explosion. No, Alanik said. I scanned the ship after they left, and there weren't any cytonics on it except for me and Jorgen.
It's possible they were in an accident returning to the planet, Kuna said. If they hyperjumped into a dangerous position, they might have been killed on return. That would explain your inability to find them, would it not?
Don't say that, I said. They aren't dead. Alanik and FM exchanged a look.
We have no evidence that they are dead, I corrected myself. We aren't going to assume that they are without evidence.
Stoff isn't going to hold off on replacing Cobb forever, FM said. Even if he thinks he can use you as a scapegoat, at some point they're going to need to name a new admiral. They're only taking your word for it that Cobb didn't die on that ship.
Alanik looked personally offended.
We are witnesses. So taking our word for it makes perfect sense.
Maybe, I said.
But FM is right. They aren't going to let this go on forever. It wouldn't necessarily be Stoff who took Cobb's place. There were two other vice admirals of equal rank, though they were both planet-side at the moment, trying to deal with the fallout of the superiority broadcasting the deaths of half the assembly to the citizens of Detritus. I didn't think Stoff wanted control of the DDF, or he would have seen Cobb's absence as an opportunity instead of a burden he was mostly trying to shift to me. I'm not sure what options we have, though, I said. Our military is too small and ill-equipped to take on the superiority once they get their forces mustered. The Erdale pilots are well-trained but inexperienced, and the superiority's technology outpaces us all. And that's assuming they don't try to send another Delver after us. Spensa said the superiority was trying to make a deal with them.
We need to continue to reach out and form other alliances, Kuna said. There will be many peoples who don't approve of Whimsic's methods.
I wasn't sure that Kuna entirely approved of our methods. They still seem to find us aggressive and barbaric, even though our tactics had saved them from capture on Sunreach.
It may be only lesser species in the beginning, they continued. But as time goes on, I'm sure the more advanced species will also begin to turn on Whimsic.
Those lesser species saved your life, Alanique muttered.
Twice now, FM added under her breath.
Of course,
Kuna said, as if this didn't contradict what they'd said previously at all.
All species have something wonderful to add to the superiority.
This isn't the superiority, I said. We're not trying to join them. Kuna wanted us to see the superiority as a diverse group of peoples, as I'm sure they were, given the thousands of planets that were apparently under their control. But the superiority has been killing our people since long before Whimsic took over, and we're not making an alliance with any part of it. Not again. Kuna looked like they might argue, but I wasn't going to hear it. Alanique had been right about the superiority. My parents had tried to reason with them, and look where that got them.
Boom,
Boomslug muttered from down by my feet, where he'd curled around the leg of my chair. I reached for him and scritched him between his spines. He nuzzled his body against my hand. Cobb ordered us to find allies, though, I said, before Kuna could make any more defenses of the superiority. So if we reach out to others, we're still following his orders. Technically, FM said, he ordered us to make allies of the Erdale.
Technically, they weren't orders at all, Alanique added. They were not orders.
That's beside the point, I insisted. If we're making alliances, then we're doing what Cobb would do. And if our superior officers know we're doing it, and they don't order us not to, then we're still operating within the current chain of command. Do you know anyone we can reach out to with the Hypercom? FM asked Kuna. Other species we could make an alliance with? Kuna shook their head, laying their hands flat on the conference table.
I have tried to reach my contacts, but some have gone underground. Others might side with Whimsic, so I have to be careful whom I reach out to. Your Hypercom does not have the databanks that mine did, and without the coordinates to reach the others...
We don't know their radio frequencies, basically, I said.
Precisely, Kuna said. I have allies among the figments, if we can reach them.
We might be able to do that cytonically, Alanique said. Though if we try to reach out to the wrong people, we might set ourselves up to walk into another superiority trap.
I nodded. We couldn't approach other cytonics indiscriminately. You can monitor hypercommunication, though, can't you? I asked Alanique. I hadn't been able to figure out how to do that yet, but Alanique seemed to do it easily. You could see if you can find any anti-superiority communication, and we could try to pinpoint the frequencies of the people who are sending them and contact them as potential allies.
Most of those who oppose Whimsic won't be using hypercoms, Kuna said. The lesser species don't have access to them, and those who do will be afraid of being overheard.
Alanique looked like she might punch Kuna if they called her lesser one more time.
If it's the only idea we have, FM said, then it's still worth a try.
I agree, I said, and we don't have to ask Staff for resources to try it, so that's even better. I turned to Alanique. I'd like to help Canvas for hypersignals, I said. You'll have to teach me, but I've caught on quicker to the communication skills than hyperjumping.
Of course, Alanique said. I'd be happy to have your assistance.
I hoped I would be of assistance, but we were getting desperate. And until we found Gran Gran, I was the only other Cytonic we had. Rig knocked on the doorframe to the conference room. His yellow hyperslug, Drape, peered over his shoulder from his perch in one of the new backpacks engineering had devised. A boom slug, as everyone had begun calling them, even though technically it was Boom Slug's name, peered over his other shoulder. Are you carrying one of those around now? I asked. That was strange. We'd mostly left the Boom Slugs alone, except for Boom Slug. Everyone else was too worried about triggering the mind blades. Rig shrugged, and the slugs bobbed along with the gesture.
Boom Slug saved my life back on Wandering Leaf, so I thought we should try to keep more of these guys around. For purely experimental purposes, of course. I'm definitely not carrying a slug as a bodyguard.
I couldn't blame him if he was. FM smiled at Rig. The two of them were scudding adorable, which lately made me want to punch things. Spence's influence, probably.
He named this one Squeeze.
Of course. FM had taken glee in naming my hyperslug Snuggles before she assigned her to me. If I hadn't already bonded with Boom Slug, they no doubt would have tried to push Squeeze on me as well. Cobb would tell me I should have more of a sense of humor about myself. He was usually right. Did you need something? I asked Rig.
Just wondering if FM was available to run drills with the slugs, he said. We've got Star Dragon Flight ready to practice with the new keywords.
The other flights had been less than thrilled when FM stole some of their Tanix, but she was largely forgiven now that the assembly had lost most of the other Tanix to the superiority. We hadn't secured enough new slugs to outfit all the flights yet, and any new ones we found in the caverns would have to start their training from scratch, which meant I shouldn't keep them from it. If she was busy, FM had less time to worry in my general direction. Yeah, we're done here, I said. How is the platform exploration going?
The team is still working on it, Rig said.
They were looking for more platform control rooms like the one on Wandering Leaf. It was similar enough to the platforms on Detritus that it seemed likely we might have some with similar capabilities. More platforms that could hyperjump or fire hyperweapons would be a valuable asset.
There is a lot of junk in the debris belt and a lot of platforms to search.
I understand, I said. Let me know if you find anything.
Will do, Rig said, as FM pushed her chair away from the table and moved to join him.
Rig didn't report to me officially, but we were all in a holding pattern until Cobb returned, so sharing information only made sense. Are you ready to look for signals now? I asked Alanique.
Yes, she said, but not here. These chairs are too square. It's distracting.
I didn't have a chance to ask what she meant, because Alanique had already stood up from her square chair and marched out of the conference room. I scooped up Snuggles and Boom Slug and followed Alanique, as she seemed to know where she was going. I hoped I'd be able to help. I had to do something, because if I didn't, the tragedies we'd suffered would only be the beginning.
Chapter 3. Alanique brought me to one of the small meeting rooms. At the head of the square table sat the weirdest chair I had ever seen. It looked as if it was made entirely from tree branches, sanded and polished and warped into twisting shapes that stretched up the back in a spiraling pattern. As I got closer, I could see that it was a continuous carving from a single large piece of wood.
Did you bring that here? I asked.
Yes, Alanique said. It was Arturo's suggestion.
I was saying that I find your furniture strangely square, and he said that if I was going to spend hours searching for Gran-Gran and Cobb in the negative realm, I might as well bring myself back a comfortable place to sit. It's my favorite from my own home.
The seat was polished wood rather than a cushion, and Alanik folded herself onto it with her legs tucked under her. There was another chair in here, which did look squarish beside hers, but it had cushions covered in a plain brown fabric and looked much more comfortable to me. I wondered if Arturo had been using it. They seemed to be spending a lot of time together. I sank into the chair. I don't know if I'm going to be any help at this.
If you're willing to try, Alanik said, it can't hurt.
I leaned back in the chair and closed my eyes. As I reached out with my cytonic senses, I could feel Alanik on the chair beside me, and Boomslug and Snuggles settling on my lap. I widened my focus and found the other slugs across the platform, and, dimly, the vibrations that indicated there were still more Tanics down on the planet that we hadn't been able to locate. I should probably be down there looking for them myself, since I could sense them and the ground crews couldn't. Maybe Cobb would use that as an excuse to send me away for a while once he returned. It would be better than bereavement leave. At least I'd have something to focus on, something to do.
Okay, Alanik said. We're going to reach away from Detritus. The universe is like a giant map, and we can examine places up close or at a distance. Do you know what I mean?
Not really, I said. I can focus in on one person's mind, or sense the cytonic vibration of a group. But I don't see locations, only people.
People,
Snuggles announced. I thought she liked being included.
Hmm,
Alanik said.
This is why you have a hard time hyperjumping, probably.
I can visualize a physical place in my mind, I said. Like I can imagine the trees of Redon because I've seen them and send that picture to Snuggles.
Snuggles, Boomslug said affectionately.
Forget about the places then, Alanik said. I think our experience of them is different. Instead, try reaching for people. But instead of looking for them, listen.
That sounded just as nonsensical, but at least it didn't require me to look for things I couldn't see. When you say listen, do you mean for things you hear? Or the way Spensa heard the stars, the way I heard the slugs, like the vibration of the universe?
Neither, Alanik said. Like when I speak in your mind. Listen for the voices of others. You can intercept their communications, whether it's hypercom or mind-to-mind. It all passes through the negative realm, and if you are passing through it at the same time...
Okay, that made sense. Thank you for explaining, I said. When Gran-Gran taught me this stuff, she mostly made me knead bread and told me to listen to the stars. It helped, weirdly, but it wasn't exactly intuitive.
That's not as bad a tactic as you might think, Alanik said. My training was similar. I can try to explain things to you, but in the end, your intuition is the only way you will learn.
I hated that. I liked things that could be explained, preferably with proven pedagogical techniques, written reference materials, and lots of concrete examples. Cytonics was the opposite of that in every way, and I couldn't help but feel that whatever force was handing these powers out had given them to the wrong person when they picked me. Spensa seized her powers and made use of them. I was floundering around in the dark. Beside me, I could feel Alanik's mind as she expanded her senses, reaching out into the void. I tried to do the same, at first looking for other minds, then listening for voices. I wondered if I could find Spensa that way, the way she'd reached out to me from the nowhere. My mind was passing through it, and if she was in there, it made sense that I would be able to find her again. I hoped every day, and even more since the explosion, that I'd hear from her. I wanted evidence she was all right, news that she was finding a way to return. But more than anything, I desperately wanted to hear her voice again.
I expanded my mind, listening. And then, just barely, I heard a snatch of something, a voice in the nothingness.
Solar flares on the... avoid the area.
I heard something, I said. Something about a solar flare.
It's a weather report, Alanique said. I found that one. It's a superiority broadcast among their hyperjumping ships, warning them about hazards as they navigate the galaxy.
Of course, Alanique had already heard it. But that didn't change the fact that I'd found it. I'd given up hope that I would be able to hyperjump, but Alanique said every Cytonic should technically have access to all Cytonic powers, even if various ones could be harder for some than for others. Maybe I wasn't completely hopeless. Maybe I could still master this, or at least gain some passable skills. I continued listening. The sounds were tiny blips in a vast area, like a Tanix hiding among all the caverns of detritus. I found another broadcast giving what sounded like navigational coordinates, and a ship captain complaining about some of his subordinates to his commander. These were all hypercom signals. They didn't originate in the nowhere. But if Spensa was in here, there had to be a way to reach her. Spensa, I thought. Are you there? Can you hear me?
Stop that, Alanique said. You're drowning everything else out.
My face flushed. Oh, right. Of course, Alanique could hear that. She was sitting right next to me, literally searching for Cytonic signals.
I can hear all of that, too, Alanique said. It would be wonderful if we could find Spensa in here and find a way to bring her home, but perhaps we could focus on one matter at a time?
Of course, I said. Sorry. I sat and listened to the echoing void of the universe, trying not to radiate any thoughts that would overpower Alanique's search. I still wished I could search for Spensa, instead of combing through mundane hypercom communications on the off chance someone might be sending anti-superiority messages through the nowhere. The more I thought about this, the more it seemed like the odds of finding such a communication at the precise moment it was being sent would be one in a million. And it was frustrating to hear the superiority using this technology like it was basic radio. They had made hypercommunication part of their civilization, while the rest of us were only now clawing our way out of the Dark Ages. Spensa would be angry about that. She probably was angry about it. I wished she were here. She'd be better at this than I was. Spensa would probably... Spensa! I opened my eyes, blinking rapidly. That hadn't been Alanique's voice, or the slug's. Had I imagined it? After everything that had happened, was I losing my mind? I reached out again, focusing on the voice. Please respond. And then it started again. Spensa, human of detritus. I found something, I said.
Where?
Alanique asked. I could feel her mind reaching out for mine, following me into the nothingness. Return them, please.
I hear it, Alanique said.
She focused on the words as they repeated again. It was an ongoing signal being broadcast on a loop. As we listened, the words became more and more clear. Spensa, human of detritus, the message said. This is the swims upstream. We have your humans and would like to return them. Please respond. They have our humans and would like to return them, I said.
That's what they said. Alanique frowned. Do they mean Cobb and Gran-Gran?
Or other humans, I said. We don't know if there are other prison planets like ours, or if we're the only ones left.
If they found an entire planet of humans, would they really be contacting Spensa to return them?
I don't know, I said. I don't know what swims upstream is. I don't have any idea who's trying to reach us. The superiority knew about Spensa and that she was connected to our planet. They knew she'd disappeared, and they were no doubt trying to find her. This might be an attempt to bait her into the open, the way they did to my parents. I supposed there was some comfort in knowing that if she was stuck in the nowhere, she couldn't fall into that trap.
I can pinpoint the coordinates, Alanik said. I could give them to the Tanix in your hypercom, so you could respond.
Should we respond? I asked.
It's a lead, Alanik said. The only one we have. And if they do have Cobb and Gran-Gran...
I reached out for the message, listening to it play again. Can you teach me how to pinpoint the message? I asked. Can we respond directly?
You said you weren't sure you should respond. Don't you want to run this by your commanders? I thought that was your answer for everything.
Alanik had me figured out. Yes, I said, but I want to know what's possible. These are skills I need to learn, even if I don't know if we should answer this particular message.
Listen then, Alanik said. You know how you can tell which mind is mine in the negative realm? You don't try to speak to me and accidentally reach the Tanix. You can even tell the individual slugs apart, can't you?
Yes, I said. At first, I got them confused, but now I can tell one from another, as long as I'm familiar with them.
Places are like that, too. They each have their own individual feeling. And even if you can't see the whole of the universe, you should be able to recognize the difference in sensation.
Like the vibrations, I said. And now that she said it, I did feel a distinct vibration coming from the message. Could I use that to communicate with it? Could I speak to the recording as if it were a person? If I tried to talk to it, would anyone hear me? I asked. It's a hypercom, not another cytonic.
It depends on whether there's a person listening on the other end, Alanik said. But you could try.
She was right that we should loop Stoff in on this. I wanted to keep an eye on things, make sure no one came up with any new terrible ideas in Cobb's absence. But I couldn't leave either the DDF or the National Assembly in the dark completely. I might be stretching the limits of my authority lately. But if I started keeping secrets from my superiors, I'd be breaking them entirely. Still, none of them were cytonics. Even if I looped in Stoff, Alanik and I would still be the only ones who could communicate with these people. I focused on the vibration of the recording, trying to treat it as if it were the mind of another cytonic or one of the Tanix. Can you hear me? I asked. The recording stopped abruptly. Right in the middle of a sentence. Hello? A voice said on the other end. Scud. They'd heard me. The voice felt different than a full cytonic mind, but I was able to target the vibration. Is this the human planet Detritus? If I told them they'd reached us, would that give anything away? The superiority already knew where we were. It is. I said, but I left it at that. The message changed.
Human, it said. This is Kauri of the Kitsen, captain of the Swims Upstream. Can you put me in touch with Spencer? Interesting, Alanik said.
What's interesting? I asked.
That they're a Kitsen, she said, or they claim to be one. They're another of the species the superiority believes to be lesser. They're small furry creatures, not unlike tree squirrels, but they're as intelligent as Urdale. I've never met one, but I've seen a picture. They look adorable.
So I was either talking to a superiority trap or a tree squirrel that knew Spencer. I wasn't sure which was more disturbing. Okay, I said. You're right that we should bring this to the attention of command. This is too sensitive to handle on our own. We need to go to the comms people with this and let Stoff know.
If you're sure that's wise, Alanik said.
I wasn't sure it was, but I also wasn't ready to strike out entirely on my own. I was merely watching over the DDF for Cobb until we could find him. Let me speak with my superiors and get back to you, I said.
We eagerly await your return, the voice said. If they are a squirrel, they're a very enthusiastic one, Alanik said.
True. I focused one more time on the vibration of the transmission.
Alanique said she could give it to Fine in the hypercom, but I wanted to learn to do this too. I waited until the vibration felt familiar, the way I could find Alanique's mind quickly now that I knew her. And then I pulled my mind back to Detritus, where I could feel the buzz of the Tainix all around, and then toward the room where I could feel Alanique sitting next to me. As I drew inward, passing by the minds of the Tainix on the platform, the area around me suddenly felt denser, bumpier, like it was filled with 100 raised ridges in the otherwise empty space. They were there, and then, as I focused on them, spontaneously absent. "Did you feel that?" I asked.
"Feel what?"
Alanique said. "That texture, like there was suddenly something else in the nowhere with us."
"Something in the nowhere? Like the eyes?"
"No, I don't think so," I said. Scud, I hoped what I'd felt wasn't some sign of an impending Delver attack. Maybe it wasn't in the nowhere, exactly. More like I could feel something through the nowhere, all around us. Not more cytonics, but... Alanique stared at me, shaking her head.
"I didn't notice anything. I don't feel anything here but you and the slugs."
Maybe I imagined it then. The idea that I was losing my mind was somehow less scary than the thought of some other, new thing emerging from the nowhere to haunt us. I need to talk to Kuna and Stoff to figure out what we're going to do next. If the Kitsin are really reaching out to us, we have to follow up on it. Whatever Stoff's motives, I hoped he continued to be accommodating. Chapter 4. Alanique followed me up to talk to Stoff, and I didn't stop her. Stoff had the entire DDF behind him, and I wanted a little strength in numbers of my own. I would have called in the whole flight if I'd thought it would help. Stoff was sitting in his office. He'd left the Admiral's office empty in Cobb's absence, which I took as another sign he wasn't looking to usurp Cobb's position. "We found a transmission from a hypercom, sir," I said. "Someone called Cowrie, looking for Spensa." "Is it the superiority?" Stoff asked. "It could be," I said, "but they claim to be a Kitsin. We have the coordinates for the message, so we can try to reach whoever it is by hypercom. The message said they have our humans and they'd like to return them. It could be Cobb and Mrs. Nightshade, but we don't know for sure." "Thank you," Stoff said. "If you get the hypercom set up, I'll speak with them." "I'd like to talk to them, sir," I said. "Alanique and I made the initial contact, and if they really are a Kitsin, that might be another group we could approach about an alliance. Cobb put us in charge of making alliances, so we should have the clearance to do so." I knew that was a stretch, but I tried not to show it. Stoff sighed and gave me an appraising look. I was pretty sure he was weighing how much rope he could give me to hang myself without looking like he was part of the problem when Cobb returned. But there wouldn't be a problem when Cobb returned, because we were doing what Cobb wanted in the first place. "All right," he said. "Your team has the most experience dealing with aliens, so you may take point." Alanique raised an eyebrow at him. I didn't think she appreciated our efforts with her people being reduced to dealing with aliens, but at least he hadn't called them lesser. "I'd like to brief Kuna on the interaction as well," I said. "They might have some insight about who we're dealing with." "Agreed," Stoff said. "I'll call the team to the command room in 30 minutes. "Thank you, sir," I said. Stoff nodded. I was dismissed. I found Kuna sitting in their living quarters with the other Dions we'd rescued from Sunreach. "We've intercepted a message from someone looking for Spensa," I said. "They claim to be a Kitsin named Cowrie."
"Oh, that's wonderful," Kuna said. "The Kitsin are among the most advanced of the lesser species when it comes to their non-aggression. It's their outdated monarchy that has kept them from ascending to full citizenship."
"I'm not sure if this really is a Kitsin," I said. "I'm concerned it might be a ploy. Winzik or his people trying to capture Spensa by pretending to be her allies."
Spensa worked with a group of Kitsin when she was training on Starsight, Kuna said. So the claim is plausible. I interacted mostly with Hesho, their former monarch. His people could be powerful allies. They've had a long military history to overcome as they've worked to be ready for inclusion among the higher species. I stared at Kuna. Our people have a long military history, I said, and that's the only reason we were able to rescue you from Winzik in the first place.
Twice, Alanik said.
Of course, Kuna said, though I wasn't sure they'd understood my point.
And your people have a distant connection with the Kitsin. They have some of the best records of Cytonic history, despite having produced no Cytonics for centuries.
We're going to talk to them over the Hypercom in a few minutes, if you'd like to join us. I need to make sure the Hypercom is ready.
I would love to join you, Kuna said.
Thank you, I said, and went off to get Fine into the Hypercom. Stoff only invited a small number of people to the meeting. He and three people from the Communications Corps sat around the conference table. Kuna and Alanik entered and took two of the remaining chairs, while I used the frequency impression I'd learned earlier to ask Fine to open communication with Kaori. I spoke into the Hypercom's microphone. Kaori, I said experimentally. Can you hear me?
Human, the voice said. We are trying to reach Spensa, who once called herself by the name Alanik. Do you know where we might find her?
Spensa is away on a mission, I said. It was true, even if it wasn't complete. We would like to speak to you, though. What did you mean when you said you had our humans?
Two humans hyperjumped to our planet a few days ago, the voice said. We believe they might have arrived here by accident. We would have contacted you sooner, but we had to commandeer a hypercom to do so.
You stole a superiority hypercom? I asked.
We did.
Kitsin are known for their bravery, Kuna said. It is a good quality if it can be divorced from violence. I was certain violence was going to be necessary before all this was over, so I didn't see that as a downside. Alanik opened her eyes.
I'm searching the area near their broadcast point, but I'm not able to find Becca Nightshade. I don't think she's there.
Kaori could be lying, or these humans might have nothing to do with us. Kaori, I said, what method did the humans use to hyperjump to your planet?
I don't know, she said. I assume one of them is a Cytonic.
Alanik shook her head, speaking quietly so the microphone wouldn't pick her up.
I'm not sensing any Cytonics in that area.
Would you be able to tell from this distance? Stoff asked.
Yes,
Alanik said, in a tone that said she didn't like being questioned by someone who had no idea what they were talking about.
I have used the location of the Hypercom signal to pinpoint the area. I am quite reliable, especially when it comes to reaching a Cytonic I'm familiar with.
If one of them is a Cytonic, I said, they should be able to reach out to us, shouldn't they? Why would you need to steal a Hypercom?
Well, Kaori said, something must have gone wrong during the hyperjump. Your humans are unconscious.
I looked at Alanik, and she shook her head. She should still be able to sense an unconscious Cytonic.
If your Cytonic died on arrival, Kuna said, you would no longer be able to sense her. Hyperjumps can be dangerous, and...
Are you certain they're alive? I asked Kaori.
Yes, Kaori said. They are breathing, and their bodies are warm. We are not experts in human health, but we believe this means they are living.